Okay, we are reviewing Sefer Shmuel 1, Shmuel Aleph, Part 2. Right, sounds like some sort of BBC serial. And it is the fall 2016 semester. Why I say that is because you'll see there are other review lessons from previous years. So I want to make clear when we're giving this lesson. Before we go into the list of topics, just to talk about a bit of the Roshei Prakim and what we studied, I want to give some general guidelines of exam technique, things that you should be aware of. Firstly, there will be 5 out of 6 questions to be answered. Right? Some of you have done my exams before, so you know exactly the routine. What that means is that please don't be brave or whatever the word is and try and do 6 in the hope that you'll gain a bit of extra affection from the teacher. The answer is no. Not going to help one iota. You'll do 6, the number 6 will just be crossed out. The last question, I won't even look at it, I don't have the time. I've got like 60 papers to grade in about 3 days. It's just not going to happen. So please don't be heroic in that sense. Do your 5 questions, and then you can disappear to the blue yonder, which I presume some of you will, as soon as you are done. Please do not book any flights within 2 hours of finishing the exam. I always tell this rather sad story, but it's a young lady who must now probably be a mother of at least 3 children. That would be my guess. This was like 7 or 8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, where she booked a flight, again, I don't remember exactly, I think it was to Israel, 5 o'clock from JFK. The exam ended at 3. So the time that she was meant to be doing the exam, she was also miraculously hoping to check in at JFK. Forget about traveling from here to JFK, which those who live in 5 towns or beyond will know that doesn't happen in 5 minutes. Can take up to 2 hours to get there. So the reality was that at 1 o'clock she came in very harassed, very, not herself, did the exam in about 15 minutes and ended up with, instead of 2 hours, and unfortunately ended up with like a C minus instead of an A. Should have got an A, but just did not do herself justice. So please don't make that mistake. If you are traveling, allow yourself plenty of time to finish the exam without worrying about how am I going to get there, where am I going to get, etc. All those kind of things you worry about for the vacation period.
Have you actually booked something?
Sorry?
Have you actually booked something?
Well, I would say if you've left yourself very little time, then you've got to look at it very carefully.
I have an interview.
So you have?
An interview.
You have an interview at?
In Brooklyn.
At what time?
Like 4:30.
4:30 and you're finishing exam at 3? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I would say that's okay, but you're not sort of going to JFK to check in as,
right.
You're not cloning yourself at that point.
Right.
Hopefully not. Okay? It's just one of those things that, I know from experience, it was a shame. She really lost out on the grade, and I don't want that to happen to anybody, right? I'm here to facilitate, I'm not here to sort of knock you down. I really don't believe that's my job. In terms of the exam itself, you'll get these wonderful blue, pink, white, or whatever cover books they are. Again, the covers are to be used just to write your name. Please do not write the answer on either the inside front cover or the inside back cover. Okay, the young lady, again, who must be now mother of at least 4 children, right? Long time ago, even longer than the other girl, wrote an answer which was brilliant. On the back cover, starting on the inside back cover, the piece, the blue paper at the end, and ending up finishing with 1 millimeter to spare on the outside of the back cover. Quite a remarkable effort, but not really the way to go about it. Certainly did not endear herself to me by doing it, even though I thought it was a pretty cool thing to do, but not necessarily in an exam. Use the books the way they're meant to be used. If you need to take a second book to write one more word, then don't hesitate. There are literally millions of these horrible little books flying around in Stern College, and we love to use them up as much as possible, at least I do. So again, just a sort of general reference in terms of technique. If you want to write on single side or double side, I guess it's probably better to do it on single side because, it's sort of it comes through the paper. The paper's not very thick. You'll see. That's something you gauge for yourself. No pink, purple, or beige pens, please. Keep the pen color either black, blue, or maybe pencil. don't commit the sin that, again, somebody committed a long time ago of writing in fluorescent pink. Because fluorescent pink cannot be read under normal light. Right? I found that the only way I could see it was actually in the dark. Just before I went to sleep with a flashlight, I could actually read the thing. It was that bad. And it was a bit of a shame. I don't have a spare copy, so you may have to lean over with somebody to look at it. You know, be sensible. Use a sensible pen or pencil or whatever, and have a spare. Don't run out of pens. You'll always be able to get a pen, but come prepared. Okay, one of the obvious things to say, but it has to be said. In terms of the actual books that you can bring into the exam, the one book that you're not allowed to bring in is the book we've been using, the Judaica, or I would say by similar conclusion, the R-Scroll. If you have the R-Scroll copy, too much commentary in here, this is not an acceptable book to have in the exam. But if you have a simple English Hebrew or Hebrew English translation, that would be quite acceptable. JPS, Koran, anything like that, and even if it's highlighted with bits of text that you want to put into the exam, that would be acceptable. Okay. In other words, I have no objection to you highlighting certain phrases which really should be mentioned in any exam. One of the big requirements from my point of view is that you show me by using text. Now, I'm not talking about chunks of text. Maybe just a phrase, maybe just a reference, whatever it may be, by doing that and using that text, that says to me that not only have you studied around the text, but you've actually studied the text itself. And therefore, there are certain phrases or certain pieces of Sefer Shmuel, which should be, if they're not going to be committed to memory, then you should know where to find them in the Sefer that you are bringing into the exam. If you can just shut the door, Julian, so then we can not have to listen to the outside disturbance. Hello, Chava. All right. In the order of questions, that's always a question that I get. Can you do it out of order? The answer is yes. Do question 6, followed by 3, followed by 1, followed by 2, whichever way around you want to do it. Please read every question carefully. That means that every question, almost without exception, has a number of parts to the question. Not always, but in most cases. And that means that you could do a question which has A, B, and C, and you'll do part A brilliantly, but you forget to do B and C, then you only get a third of the points. That's it. Nothing I can do. If you haven't written on B and C, I cannot grade you on B and C. You didn't write anything. So please really be careful about that. And again, if you decide, for instance, to do A, B, and C as one answer, not as different sections of an answer, then make it clear to me that's what you're doing. And as you go along, say, now starting section B, now starting section C. Make it clear to me what you're doing, that you are answering every section of each question the way that it is required to be answered. Okay? I want to make that, again, absolutely clear. In terms of the amounts, people always ask what should be written. I don't like answers which are just going to be like bullet, points. Each answer should be presumably some sort of paragraph, maybe a bit longer, maybe a bit shorter, but certainly not, A, B, C, and D, just points. But, for instance, if you get a question on the Witch of Endor, I'll just give you one example, and you're asked to give all the different points of view, was it for real or not, then not just, no, you don't, I don't want you just to go 1, 2, 3, and 4, yes, no, perhaps, but I want you to say yes and explain what you mean. This is according to, and if you remember the name of the rabbi, even better, but if you don't, you won't be penalized for that. I don't expect you to remember the names of the rabbis, but what I am expecting is that you have an awareness of what has been said. So if you're quoting Menashe ben Isser, you don't have to remember his name, but he spoke about the soul being, still around in this world, and you can connect to the soul, whatever that means, and that is his explanation of what the Witch of Endor was actually doing. Okay, so make it clear when you give your explanation, not necessarily telling me who said it, but more to the point what is being said by writing a a decent paragraph about that particular point. Okay, so I want that again to be absolutely clear. No prizes for finishing quickly. I would say again the average time between an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half. Some of you will finish 45 minutes, some of you like to finish quickly, but my general experience is that if you take a bit more time and write a bit neater, you know, so I can read the thing, which is always a big challenge, or not always, but in some cases can be a bit of a challenge, make sure that if you do all of the stuff that you're meant to do, there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't do well. Okay, there are a lot of pointers that I'll be giving you in the next couple of minutes in terms of what sort of questions are coming up. You know, just listen carefully and hopefully, you know, it'll give you enough material to take away from this lesson and from what we've done this semester to be able to tackle the exam with confidence and with ease, I hope. Okay? Hate exams, but nothing you can do. Any questions till now? Yes?
Do you prefer brevity so you don't have to read?
I prefer that you express yourself to the best of your ability. So if it takes a bit longer and you write a bit more, do not remotely worry about that, right? It's my problem, it's not your problem. I wouldn't say you repeat yourself over and over again, because that will work against you.
So just where the girl was writing a lot, and you just wanted to be spaced out so that you can read it, but you don't care about the length.
Correct. Absolutely no care. But again, I wouldn't sort of overdo the point, because as I said, when inevitably ends up being repetitious, which is not a great thing. Okay, there's a certain amount of presentation, you know, the sort of stuff which every sort of discipline which is taking things seriously will expect you to be able to produce, you know, an essay which is readable, which is well presented and well thought out. Okay, and that's usually the requirement. Any questions about exam technique, situation, books that you can use in the exam? I want to make that absolutely clear, what you can, what you cannot use. Trying to think, is anything else that we need to talk about on the general side? I think that's pretty much it. That is pretty much it. Okay. If anything else comes up, if you think of anything, please ask. If you have any questions, let me say this again. Please don't hesitate. rebschaff@aol.com. Right? As I told you, I'm not going to be around in the country for 10 days, but hopefully be in contact, email contact, so that may not get back to you as quick as I normally would, but hopefully within a day or two you will get some sort of response. What I do find a bit frustrating is on the day of the exam getting an email half an hour before the exam, can you please explain? Right, that's leaving it a little bit late. Okay, don't wait till the day of the exam. If you've got a question, send it out before then and I will try and get back to you as soon as I can. Okay, so that's that from my point of view is the hope. Okay, any questions or shall we move on? We're going to move on. Review for Sefer Shmuel, number one. What we're going to do here, go through some of the major points that we spoke about, going right back into those early days of August, and we started off at chapter 16, the white lie and the anointment of David. Anybody, what do I mean by a white lie? What was happening at the beginning of chapter 16, which demanded a response and explanation in terms of the behavior of Shmuel? Shmuel has just seen Shaul fail. What was Shmuel commissioned to do, and what was he really worried about? Anybody, please help me out. It's really important. Please, yes.
Hashem wanted.
Excellent, because what happened was, as Shoshana rightly said, if Shaul would find out, what would Shaul do? Likely that he would kill Shmuel. That was Shmuel's concern. And remember, we spoke a bit about Rabbi Bachrach. We've spoken about his commentary a lot. So he's one of those commentaries that would certainly be worth sort of referring to in any of your questions, in which he said something about most of these things. He writes about the whole concept of what exactly was Shmuel worried about, right? And for instance, one of the comments he says, Ein Sof Chalanes. Shmuel was worried that, you know, at the end of the day, you don't rely on miracles. So if Shaul was going to be really antagonistic and upset and everything else, then Shmuel was concerned that he would take it out on his Rebbe, on Shmuel. And whether that was a realistic concern or not, but it was certainly Shmuel's worry. Hashem says to Shmuel, don't worry, right? Say to Shaul or to anyone from Shaul's camp who stops you, you're taking a korban to Beit Lechem. Right? Take an animal. Some say Egla because it says Egla Rufi, you're doing the ceremony. You know, when you find a corpse between two sitters, there's a special ceremony which the rabbis or the Dayanim have to make. And Shmuel can argue he was doing that, but it wasn't true. So what did we say? This is a white lie. So what was the question, obviously? Is such a white lie permitted? Okay, it seems to be not telling the truth. So we answered that when it comes to situations like this, where, you know, you're dealing with life and death situations, sometimes economical use of the truth would be permitted. Okay, the famous Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai say, when you go to the wedding, say to everybody what you think, whether the color is in your eyes pretty or not pretty, say what you think about the color. Not really very, you know, certainly was not probably invited to many weddings because of that. One can only imagine what sort of things he might have said. But when it comes to Hillel, they would say no. Kala nai v'chasuda. You say that phrase, which we know we make into, we dance and whatever, those words, because it is saying that every color is na'er, is beautiful, v'chasuda, even if it's only in the eyes of the chatan, doesn't matter. The reality of it is, you're not really telling something which is false, but at the same time, you know, objectively, it may not be true, but we are giving an allowance to be economical with the truth. It's called a white lie, right? Lying midvar sheker tirchak, keep away from sheker. But in this case, when it's a white lie, it may very well be allowed. The proof is from the brothers of Yosef, coming up in the parsha in a few weeks' time. As soon as Yaakov dies, what do they say to Yosef? Before your father died, what did he say to us? He said to us, he made us promise that, remember the story? Chapter 50 of Sefer Bereishit. What did the brothers say to Yosef? Before he died, he told us to tell you, don't take revenge on the brothers, right? And of course, the Rashi says over there, and it's brought from the Gemara, that this conversation never ever took place between Yaakov and the brothers. His sons never heard it from him. Why did they say it to Yosef? Because now that the father is gone, they were worried Yosef would take revenge. He's the king of Egypt. Do whatever he wants. Okay? Says Yosef, and he cries at that suggestion, he says, I love you guys. I can't remotely imagine why Abba was so suspicious, and he pushes off the whole thing. But the fact that they saw that they were allowed to make this type of comment clearly shows that what we call a white lie for the preservation of peace, Ibnei Dachi Shalom, the Gemara says, to preserve the ways of peace, is allowed. Okay, that's one example. Well, the lie is that Abba said, don't take revenge. So Yosef, for goodness sake, don't kill us. And he never said it. And we gave another example from the Gemara that Rabbi Gamliel also had a dream from Hashem, which seemed to suggest that his style of leadership was, in fact, accepted, when the Gemara actually says the whole dream was there just to make Rabbi Gamliel feel a bit less upset about what had happened. He'd been pushed out of the chief rabbi's position. And the whole thing was done again in order to calm him down. Okay, so again, even though it wasn't true what the dream represented to Rabbi Gamliel, Hokamor and Brachot, but the same principle exists. When it's a white lie for the purposes of preserving, in this case, Rabbi Gamliel's sanity, excuse me, then it seems to have been accepted, it was allowed. So that's another example. If you look at your notes, we had a number of examples. Yeah. Bella. We did. If you look at the handout that I gave you, you'll see that the Yosef example is the first example of the handout. Okay, and if you don't have it, have a look in chapter 50 of Bereishit, pasuk. It's around pasuk tetvav tetzai. That's where the conversation takes place. They come back from burying Yaakov, and the brothers are petrified. Quite interesting. They're petrified that Yosef will finally take revenge. Right, they realize they did a terrible thing by selling him as a slave, really signing a death warrant essentially for Yosef. The fact that he survived and everything that happened, they are still worried that he is holding a grudge. And Yosef is a tzaddik, he's not going to hold a grudge against anybody. You don't do stuff like that. So that's one example. If you look at the notes, the handout, that was the first example on the page. Okay, so I hope, Bella, you're okay with that. If you're not sure, look at...
Yeah, I'll figure it out.
Yeah, figure it out. It's Bereshit chapter 50, the last chapter of Bereshit, Pasuk, around verse 15, 16, Tedvav, Tedzai.
Should we know, like, the Abarbanel's four reasons?
Again, if you can mention the name of the Abarbanel, that would be brilliant, but not necessarily remembering the Abarbanel, but not even the four reasons, maybe just one or two of the ideas. Right? I'm looking upon this more as ideas than as sort of exact explanations. What would be the reason why Shmuel would be afraid? And we said, according to Barbanel, I just gave you an example, ain't so chalanes, you don't rely on a miracle. So that was Shmuel's consideration. Alright? Or, you know, we said a whole bunch of other things which you can look up in your notes. Okay? The anointment of David was such a beautiful story. The fact is that David himself had been sidelined by his father, right? It turned out that we said at the end that David being a shepherd, as I said at the time, was a bit of a surprise. I always thought being shepherd was a good preparation for leadership, but in the case of David HaMelech, it was an excuse to sideline him. He was pushed out of the house, all right? His yichus was in question. Remember the whole story with his mother, that she had behaved like Rachel and Leah, that whole sort of switch, right, between her and the servant, the woman who was in the house, and all this sort of thing that had happened with Yishai. And David was born as a child from what they considered essentially was an adulterous relationship. Okay, they never considered David to be one of the direct brothers in the family, and therefore they sidelined him. They really did not take David seriously. So along comes Shmuel and says, "I've got to anoint somebody from the brothers, from the sons of Yishai." They bring in all the sons, and nothing happens. Shmuel is not impressed, and then he says, "Anybody else?" And David, sitting in the field, doing his communing with God. He's a Tehillim guy, right? Literally, he wrote the Tehillim. They call David in, and immediately, a midrash says, a beautiful midrash, that the oil jumped onto his head, right? Everybody else, the oil bounced back into the bottle. Special oil, Shemen Shalnes. But in this case, the Shemen went straight onto David's head as a sign that David was to be anointed as the new king of Israel. Not known by the public for a long time, but already designated by Hashem through Shmuel. And what again is so interesting, this beautiful image that is created of everybody standing around. Odecha ki anitani, these psukim that we say in Halal. Right, David said, I'm praising you, Hashem, ki anitani, that you've answered me, or that you afflicted me. In other words, he was afflicted originally because he wasn't taken seriously. Fatili vishuran, you became my salvation. You took me, put me in this position. Evemos abonim, so the father says, he was rejected. Haitala Rashpina is now the cornerstone of the monarchy of Israel. It's unbelievable. And the brothers say, Meit Hashem, Meit Hazod, this is from God. We don't know what's going on. We have no clue. Because this little brother, David, is not one of our favorite brothers. Similar to Yosef, similar kind of attitude. And Shmuel turns around. Zeh Yom HaSah Hashem, Nagil HaMischovo, it's the day of God, let's rejoice. Okay, and we even sort of sing a very nice Kalabach tune to the whole thing. It's very beautiful. It's really a wonderful image of all the people standing around with their various reactions to the events of the anointment of David. Any questions? Otherwise we will move on swiftly to number two. The Goliath episode, Star Wars of a spiritual nature. What do I mean by Star Wars? What do I mean spiritual nature? Right? Normally a battle is between two, not people, between two armies, right? Army number one, army number two. And in this case, what was the agreed arrangement? It wasn't between two armies, but between two people. Between Goliath, and David. Well, David not originally, but David was the one who volunteered. What was Shaul's reaction to the whole thing? He's sitting in his tent, and he is petrified. He just has lost any confidence that he had as the king. Remember, all of the holiness went away from him. That extra Ruach HaKodesh that now descended on David was gone from Shaul. That's why he loses a lot of his perspectives, we're going to say in a minute. And he is petrified because Goliath represents not just a physical presence, but Goliath tries to defeat the spiritual nature of the Jewish people. How does he do that? What does he do which is really, really quite disgraceful? Am Yisrael are trying to daven. What does Goliath do at the same time? Yeah, he curses them. So they're trying to concentrate on Shema Yisrael. What does Goliath do? He screams abuse at Am Yisrael at that moment. So they're davening. The Midian is being interrupted because this larger-than-life, disgusting individual is essentially trying to stop them from focusing on spiritual values. And that is as bad as it comes. That's why I said it's Star Wars. This is not a battle which is just, getting up at the crack of dawn, pistols at dawn, right? You know, having a shot at each other, okay? Some sort of random way of deciding the love of their lives, you know, this sort of French idea of a duel. This is not a duel. This is a spiritual dimension. There is within, and in fact the focus of the battle is much more of a spiritual nature than physical. Physically speaking, Goliath should have won it hands down. He's 10 times larger than David, both in height and in width, given phenomenal proportions. You know, David seems to be very small. How old was David? You remember what we said? At this point, he's always presented as a young boy, but he really wasn't. Right? Remember how old we said he was? The Midrash brings a number. Quite surprising. Okay, he was 28 years old. Worth remembering. At the story of Goliath, David is 28. He's not a youngster. But, at the same time, he's so full of emunah. And he hears the what he calls the arel. Ha-plishti azeh. Remember, we said the word plishti polesh. Polesh means to invade. He's an invader. He's invading our space. He's invading our world. He's trying to put us off our game. Our game is a spiritual game, like Bilam tried to do. Same thing. Okay, tried to focus on the spiritual element of the Jewish people and trying to stop them sort of being close to Hashem. And in a way, Bilam succeeded in his plan at the end. And this is what Goliath is trying to do here in order to win the battle against the Jewish people. And what is so unbelievable is that David goes out not with weapons but with emunah. All right, he's even tries on the, as I said over here, number 5, the uniform. We'll talk about that in a minute. And look at the way even that whole story turns out. It's quite remarkable. David is such a spiritual giant. Even though in stature he seems to have been quite small, but in his connection to God, Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. That's King David in the book of Tehillim. I think it's Tehillim 51, if I'm not mistaken, but you can check it out. Shiviti Hashem, every shul has that phrase more or less at the front of the shul. Remember that you're standing before Hashem. Any comments, any questions? Yes, Bella, please. Okay, we can come back to it. So that's number 2. And again, I think to understand Isha Benayim, that's one of the phrases you should be remembering, the description of Goliath, the idea Benayim, Loshem Binyan, right? His physicality, the description of his weapons, description of the body of the man, right? He even loses his name towards as the story continues. It's not about him, it's about what he represents. The physicality that he represents is extreme, because he's trying to fight the spiritual power of Am Yisrael with an attack on our spirituality by being so incredibly physical. And David says it's not about anything else. I know he's covered from head to toe in armor. Doesn't make one blind bit of difference. If Hashem wants me to win, Hashem will help me win. He throws the stone, boom, finds the one little space between the helmet and his forehead, and Goliath is completely immobilized at that moment. He's killed. Quite remarkable, yeah.
Did you say Polish or
Polish? Polish, Plishti. Oh, okay, Pelam and Shin. Means to invade. Polash means, literally, Polish is someone who invades territory. Polshim. And it's very interesting, the focus of the David-Goliath story is therefore a focus of spiritual versus physical. Okay? As I called it here, the Star Wars kind of principle of trying to understand two different forces, right, coming up against each other. And of course David goes with his faith. The brothers are pretty upset with the fact he's even there. We're going to talk about that in a minute. That's number 3, Eitza Amuka. The fact that David comes to the front line in the first place is very shocking for the brothers. Why? Why are they so shocked that he's there? Because what do they consider David as being? Right? What is he, as far as they're concerned? From day one. What is his job? What does he do? Is he a soldier? Is he a warrior? No, he's a shepherd. Right? He doesn't tell them that he had a fight with a lion, or was it, or with a bear, and he managed to sort of kill them with his bare hands. Doesn't really go into those details. The brothers didn't know. Eitza Amuka. It says with the story this week's Parsha, in the episode of Yosef going to visit his brothers, right? Remember that the brothers have gone to Dotan, they've gone to Shechem or wherever, and the father sends Yosef to go to the brothers. So Chazal, the rabbis, are very perplexed. And they say that when it says that Yosef was being sent to, is called Emek Chevron, the Valley of Chevron. And the problem is, if you go to Chevron, as many people did 2 weeks ago, Parsha Chayei Sarah, right? A lot of people go every year. You'll find that Chevron is not a valley, but Chevron is actually a very high up location. It's on a hill, it's on a mountain. So it's Har Chevron, right? So the question therefore is, what does it mean by Emek Chevron? That he was sent from Emek, from the valley, from the depths. Say the rabbis, the word Emek has got an allusion to Eitza Amuka. Eitza Amuka means there is a depth of analysis here coming from Hashem. Hashem realized that for Jewish history to take the turn that it was going to take, Yosef had to be sent to the brothers. That would facilitate Yosef being sold as a slave, going to Mitzrayim, and the whole of Jewish history unfolding. By the same token, we are saying Eitza Amuka applies also to David being sent to the front line. Made no sense to the brothers that their father would send David to the front line, and the reality of it is he goes and he's there, and of course the whole of Jewish history changes as a result of David being there. He hears about the challenge, he hears about the fact that the king is shaking in his boots, literally. He hears about all of the negative stuff, and he says, this is not the way we fight as Jews. As Jews, we fight with our koach ha-ruchani, our spiritual values. And he turns around and says to Goliath, he doesn't even say to Goliath, Goliath looks at him and says, are you joking? Right, you're coming to fight me? You're nothing, you haven't even got a sword, he carries nothing. And David says, B'shem Hashem Nazkir, I'm coming in the name of God. He brings up the stones, five pebbles, some say Keneged, the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. They've got sort of a kind of symbolism, the stones. Throws one of the pebbles and boom, Goliath is history. He's gone. Quite extraordinary. Who is Goliath descended from and who is David descended from? Right? What did we say? Goliath is descended from, what's her name? The two sisters. Book of Ruth, right? Orpah. Whereas David is descended from Ruth. And what happens in the story of David and Goliath is uniting, a reconnecting of those two sisters. One who went off to Moab, Orpah, who became, unfortunately, so abused, right? She was raped and all the rest of it when she went back to her people. That, as a result of that total abuse that was done towards her, was born eventually Goliath. Not necessarily her son, but certainly comes from the line of descendants. Whereas David comes from Ruth, who made the tremendously beautiful commitment to Am Yisrael, Amecha Ami, Elokeich, Elokeich, your God is my God, your people are my people, etc. So all of the elements of David and Goliath represent the original Ruth, Orpah story, where Naomi says, you're going with me, or you're going against me. And Orpah says, I'm going home, and Naomi and Ruth says, I'm coming with you. Right? So it's all revisited all over again. It's really quite spectacular. So all of this is sort of to be understood in terms of the Goliath episode, as I called it. The David and Goliath story, not a normal duel or anything like that. This is a spiritual versus physical battle. The battle of the good versus the bad. The strong versus the weak. The empire versus whatever. I haven't seen that, the recent Star Wars films, but I can't fill in the blank. But I think I did see the original when it came out about 500 years ago. Isn't that amazing? Yes, please.
Where is Ella and the Eight Sons of Kaf from?
Yeah, it's from, not from our chapter, but it's a similar comparison to this week's Parsha of Parsha Vayeshev, chapter 37. Perek Lamed Zayin in Bereishit. Eitzah Mukan, there's a whole reference there to where it refers to Emek Chevron, right? And the rabbis say Emek doesn't really fit as a description of Chevron. It's on a mountain. Emek means a valley. Can't be Chevron on a valley because there's no such place, right? It's on a mountain. So say the rabbis, no, it's not a geographical description of Chevron. It is the Eitzah Mukan from God who's represented in Chevron by those tremendous representatives, the Avot, etc. God is sending a message to in this case, to Yaakov, to send Yosef to his brothers to facilitate the future of Am Yisrael, as was Yishai inspired to send David to the front line to facilitate the future of the kingdom of Israel. Okay, something which is also extremely important.
Can we have this on a handout?
It is on a handout, yes. Yeah, there's a handout about Eitzah Mukan. Number four, Rubatam. Okay, what did David go to bring to his brothers? So there's about, I think, four or five different explanations. Help me out here. What is the one of the explanations? All right, when people go to war, what did they usually do? Instituted by the Bet Din of David, if not before. They went to war. What did they? How would they leave their wives? They would give them a get, right? It's called a conditional divorce. If they come back, then the get is cancelled. If they don't come back, then retroactively, from the moment they gave it, it becomes valid, and therefore, if the husband is declared missing, and he never see him again, the wife is no longer married, and she can go remarry. Solves the problem of what we call agunot, one of the serious problems this very day. Some say Arubatam was just basically taking them their money or their you know, care packages. What was the whole thing with the money that they had borrowed money for making? What did they have to make of their own volition? Quite amazing. They go to war. What were they not given? Which you would think they would be given. Sorry?
Food
is one thing, but even more basic.
Weapons.
What do you need in war? Weapons. They would have to make their own weapons. And they would take loans, and Yishai sent David with the money that they could pay off their loans. Alright, that's another suggestion. And again, most suggestions are either talking about the food, talking about the money, or talking about the divorce arrangements. Says Rabbi Bachra, no. All of this is good, but I'm going to suggest something much more historical. What was Arubatam? From the word Arev, means a guarantor. Why was David going to Saul, to Shaul at this time? David from the tribe of Yehuda, Shaul from the tribe of Benjamin. What does this refer back to? Which story? Right, we're going to be reading this very soon in the parasha next week.
Mitzrayim.
Yeah, Mitzrayim. And David, representing Yehuda, was the son of Yaakov, who says to Yaakov, I know that this strange guy in Egypt wants to see Binyamin. I take responsibility, Arev. I am a guarantor for Binyamin. Right, and I will take everything on my own shoulders to be responsible if he does not come back. And he makes a tremendous commitment to his father. Say the rabbis, that is reflected Arubatam in this word in the chapter that we read now. What David is doing by going to the front line, he is continuing the commitment of Yehuda to be caring, looking out for the tribe, or the representative in this case, of Binyamin. Yehuda is worrying again about Binyamin. And Shaul's from Binyamin. And not only that, which is so interesting, is that it happens again later on. They meet up again in the story of the Megillah, right, which we've already referred to. The Megillah Esther, where again, the Mordechai is called Ish Yumini. He's from Binyamin, but he's also Ish Yehudi. Right? So some say that his father was from Benjamin, and his mother was from Yehuda. So again, we have Yehuda and Binyamin intertwined in an act of salvation, an act of redemption, represented by Mordecai. Yeah.
What was David bringing? What was he the guarantor for Shaul for? Like, he was bringing him back.
Bringing him, protecting him, actually protecting him from his uncontrollable fear, the way it's describes him, of Goliath. He just, and we know, and this is an interesting thing to mention, if you look at chapter 4 of the book of Shmuel Aleph, you'll see in that particular war with the Plishtim that is described there, Rashi tells us that one of the refugees of the war, one person who got away, was none other than Shaul, before he became king. And he had already encountered Goliath. He knew what Goliath was. And therefore, now that he's the king and he has to go into the ring again with Goliath, as they say, has to have another fight, he is petrified. Alright? And particularly as his whole spiritual strength has been removed, because when he lost the kingship, the future of the kingship, it went from him to David. Alright? I hope that's all remembered as we explain. Number 5, the uniform of Shaul. What was so symbolic about his uniform? When David put it on, what miracle took place? Shaul is size, let's put it into dress sizes. Shaul is size 16, David is size 0. And what happens when he puts on the dress, or the equivalent? It fits him. Don't have to go to do any alterations whatsoever. Imagine that. Wow, saves a lot of time. But the problem is, what is David so concerned about? When people see David walking out with the king's uniform, and it fits them perfectly, they know it's the king because he's got all his stuff written all over it, all his symbols. What will the people say? That this is, you know, the sign that David is now ready, declaring David the new king. It will be so embarrassing for Shaul, who is still the king of Israel. It will be like, as they say, a punching pot in. It will be a punch in the face for Shaul. And David does not want to remotely be responsible to cause any grief, embarrassment, or pain to the king of Israel. David's policy towards Shaul was unique and incredible. As much as Shaul tries to attack him, to kill him, whatever, David's attitude is, Shaul is Bechir Hashem, the chosen one of God. Who are we? Mashiach Hashem, to touch the anointed one of Hashem. We cannot go near him. We should respect him and love him. David's a remarkable man. Very few Davids in the world. The symbolism of clothing is something, again, we spoke about. The cloak that is torn, right, when Shaul loses the kingship, Shmuel turns around and leaves him, and Shaul grabs his cloak. And that, again, is a symbol of losing the kingship. All right, the cloak represents the connection between the person and his situation. The clothes maketh the man, in this case, right? To quote the phrase. And all of that is very, very significant with the clothing of the king and David, who refuses to wear any uniform whatsoever. He goes out almost bare-chested, I suppose you would say, but with his trusty sling and trust in Hashem. Bitachon. Unbelievable. Number 6, I'm going to really try and get through this. Shaul's strange question at the end of chapter 17. He says, who is the lamb? Why is it strange? Because he knows David. David's been playing music for him for the last sort of, you know, 6 months or a year. He's called David because he heard that David was a good musician and he calmed him down. Music calms the beating heart, or whatever expression like that. Okay, music is a very good calming influence. If you're going to get stressed out over the next 2 weeks, go back to your room, put on your headphones, and listen to Max Bruch, B-R-U-C-H, his fantastic symphony, violin symphony, and you will be so chilled. By the time you finish listening to that, you will be able to do any exam in the world. I guarantee you, even though you may not choose to listen to it, it is beautiful. It will calm you down. Maybe you like listening to heavy metal, but I don't think that's a very calming kind of music. Whatever. Music that really does. Mordechai Ben David, not so much. Shalshalet, maybe. A bit better. Maccabees, no comment. Don't know what to say about those guys. Nice bunch of guys. I don't want to. So anyway, whatever it is, whatever works for you. Music was phenomenally important for Shaul. And for him to ask, who is the lad? Strange question. So what did we say? What was his question in reality? Not who is David, but which family? Where's his yichus? Is this the new king of Israel? Avner, who's by his side, his uncle Abner, he's asking,
He says, Uncle Abner, who is this young man? Is he coming from the line of parents? From the line of parents and...
Zerah.
Zerah, correct. Well done. Right, also, this week's parasha, should be, I'm not quite up to that part of the parasha yet. Is he coming from those very important lines of descent? If he is, and it turns out that he is, then who is the lad is a question that is a sort of rhetorical question saying, I know now, in my own mind, I know this is the new king of Israel. Right? Even though he won't be declared the king of Israel until I'm gone, but the reality of it is, he is definitely in line. Right? Can't be anybody else but the new king of Israel. So that whole discussion at the end of chapter 17 is really significant. You'll see half of the points here that we've just been speaking about are on two chapters. Remember, we spent a lot of time on those two parakim, certainly worthy of looking over all of your stuff yet again. Number 7, the love of David and Jonathan, a spiritual approach. We said that to learn that this was just a pure physical kind of connection doesn't really fit into the description. We said this was nefesh, benefesh, that using the phrase. They literally were soulmates. And why was this particularly unbelievable? Because what was Yonatan going to become? The next king of, finish the sentence, Israel. Good. And of course, what it means is that Yonatan would have become the next king, but who is it instead? David. David took away his position. This should be enemy number one. He should have a dartboard in his room with a picture of Yonatan, which he throws darts at every day, or the equivalent in the ancient world. And we know that instead of having a dartboard, he had a picture in his mind, in his heart, in his soul, that this was the person more than anybody else, the ultimate chavruta, the person that he could connect to in such a deep spiritual way. How do we understand it? Because it wasn't, their love was not a physical-based relationship, as many people in the modern world have tried to bring a proof from this, but there's absolutely no proof to say that. On the contrary, everything we read about them is in terms of their spiritual aspiration. David aspired to get closer to God, and Yonatan was, as they say nowadays, on the same page. Also aspired to become more connected to Hashem, to become more spiritual. And between the two of them, these were like the two best boys in the yeshiva, learning all the time, trying to become more and more sort of, embedded in Torah knowledge and awareness of Hashem. Okay, and that's what is so unique about it. Remember the Pirkei Avot, Ava She'ina Tzluya B'davar. This was a friendship which was not dependent on anything, right? Had no preconditions. And in fact, I think, remember, Rav Bachrach says that the ultimate explanation, Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha, is the explanation for Yonatan's behavior. Ahavta L'Recha, when your friend is successful, Kamocha, you consider it as if it's more, or it's like you being successful. In other words, you're happier for your friend to succeed than even when you yourself succeed. Because his success gives you so much pleasure. And this is not the world that we generally associate with the world around us, where there is competition, where people try to undercut each other. This is not the world of tzaddikim. The world of tzaddikim is that I try to aim for 100, and I get 99.99, so along comes Yonatan and says, well, I can do 99.99999. Are they ever going to do 100? These guys, they probably could. But what they're trying is trying to inspire each other to get that bit closer to Hashem. Remarkable young men. Really remarkable. And their relationship, you can see the way they talk to each other, the commitments they make, the covenants they make, right? All of that is part of this discussion. If you want to talk about David and Jonathan, remember their covenants, particularly the famous story when they part from each other, chapter 21, I think it is, how sad it is that they say we won't see each other ever again, and we make a commitment between not only us, ourselves, but it says between our future generations, that we will always be connected to each other, all right? And it's very, very beautiful. Doeg, yeah, are we with him or against him? What's the general consensus? We are generally against Doeg. He's not one of our favorites. A man, the head of the Sanhedrin, very powerful dude, very powerful individual, man of great Torah knowledge. But it doesn't always guarantee that the character will go along with it. Alright, I really believe that's true right to the present day. A lot of people in the Torah world, very knowledgeable, but what sort of person are they? What sort of mensch? Some are, and I have to add, some of them that I've met really are not, really disappointed. And Doeg is sort of one of those characters. He complained from day one. He never accepted David. Why? Because he said that the rule that was made about Ruth was wrong. What was the rule? Is an Ammonite or a Moabite allowed to convert? Torah says essentially no, but says the Bet Din of Shmuel, Bet Din of Boaz originally, what did they say? That only applied to the men, but not to the women. The women were allowed to become Jewish. So Ruth converted. She became Jewish. Therefore David is, by default, Jewish. Says Doeg, don't accept it. Don't accept it, never have accepted it. Maybe Doeg had a different oral tradition about all of this, right? Because remember, we're talking about oral Torah not being written down. So there were different traditions that may have been sort of in existence. And the bottom line of all of this was that for Doeg, David was illegitimate. He was not the man who was meant to be in this position of power. And Doeg, unfortunately, he allowed a lot of his own personal animosity to David take over his situation. Where do we see it? The worst example of it. What does he do? The king says all the Kohanim in Nob have to be killed. Who volunteers to kill them? None other than Doeg. Right? Very unpleasant. Does the king's command. I mean, he's not doing anything wrong in pure terms, but look what he did. Sorry?
Because they sheltered David.
Moreid b'malchut, David was considered a rebel and the king was allowed to make that decision. It's not one of the things that he's criticized for in the end, but it was so strict. It was, as they say in Hebrew, chumrah shebechumrot. This was so strict, it was above and beyond any acceptable limit of stricture. And what is so interesting in the end, of course, is the midrashic or a Talmudic description in the Beit Midrash, that they were having this description, this discussion yet again about the whether David was kosher or not. And along comes Amasa ben Yeter, one of the generals of the army, and he puts a sword in the ground. Right? Remember, we spoke about this. Remember the story. And he says that anyone who doesn't accept David as a Jew will have to deal with the sword. In other words, he was prepared to kill somebody over it. He was prepared to take the sword and use it because he felt that not accepting David was in breach of the very fundamental oral tradition which had been established in the days of Shmuel and prior in the days of Boaz. Unbelievable. What a way to settle an argument. Right, here's the sword. It's either the sword or nothing. Scary. Yes?
I'm sorry, you said earlier that who said you have to kill all of
Kohanim? Again, that was the decision of the king, Shaul. Because they harbored David. And that's chapter 20, 21, 22. Right? And what happens in the end? David escapes, but Doeg comes along and carries out the death sentence of the king. 85 Kohanim were killed. Shocking. Shocking story. Yes, Bella, please.
So Doeg is after, David and Yonatan is perfect flesh, and then Doeg is like
Perek Kaf Aleph Kaf Bet, but we see him already in chapter 16. Doeg is the guy who already cast aspersions on David. He's not mentioned by name. Rashi says it. Rashi says that Doeg was already the guy who said, David, you want to call him in, you say that he can do this, he can do that. It's not really true. Alright? He was already doubting David right from the beginning. So Doeg was kind of the antithesis. He was the nemesis or nemesis. I don't know how you pronounce it, but we say over across the pond the word nemesis, right? Very good word of David HaMelech, and really was a bit of a problem. Number nine, Shaul's illness, Rav Bachrach's approach. Three options. Number one, that he was mad, and we said that can't really fit into any of the discussion because Shaul had such a great following. If the king was mad, the people would lock him up and move on to a new king, right? Not really easy to turn around and say that the king is crazy. Second suggestion, I'm saying it very briefly, second suggestion is that maybe it's a form of tragedy, that he was like this was his fate, right, that the king had to go through all of this terrible circumstance because it was decided in some sort of Greek tradition that, you know, Shaul was a tragic figure. Again, it doesn't work in the Jewish world. There's Bechira, etc. We don't believe in these Greek concepts. So says Rabbah, the only way we can explain it is to understand that Shaul was jealous of David, but spiritually so. He understood that David had received the spiritual energy that Shaul had received once upon a time as king. When he stopped being king, the energy went from Shaul and landed on the head of David. And he knew it. Shaul understood it. Shaul perceived it. He could see just by the way David behaved. David glowed. He was glowing. And the reality of it is that Shaul became very affected by this, to the point, says the Malbim, where he developed melancholy, which is a 19th century way of describing what we call depression. Okay, he became melancholic, he became depressed. So at a certain point, Shaul was very with it, and if you have to answer a question, talk about what happened at En Gedi, chapter 24, and answer the question also from chapter 26, because there you see how Shaul becomes clear-minded, and David, Bini, calls him my son, and he has this kind of reunion with David for the last time. But when he is unfortunately not so clear-minded, his only focus is to take David and kill him. And how sad that is. What they call a love-hate relationship. Much more of the hate, unfortunately, than the love. So that's Shaul's illness, three different approaches. Please look at your notes. And probably, my guess is there'll be a question on it, or something to that effect. Okay? Without giving away too much. Abigail. Has to be a question with Abigail. Okay? I find Abigail one of the quintessential Talmidei Chachama. What does she do? She stops David in his tracks, okay, by storyline. She takes all the food that Naval, her rather unpleasant husband, did not want her to give to the helpers of David. Right? David was responsible for 400 men, and he needed food, and she refused. Naval was his cousin, or a distant cousin of David, and as a result, David decided that in his position as the king-elect, not the king, but the king-elect, he could already judge Naval to be liable for death. Starts running with his men, 400 men, all with swords, ready to kill Naval. And who's standing in their way? None other than Abigail. And she's standing there, and according to the Gemara, an amazing statement of the Gemara, which is that she starts having a halachic debate with David. She knows how to stop David in his tracks. David, she says, I've got a bidika, I've got a piece of cloth there. It's got blood on it. Is it tahor or tameh? Am I pure or impure? Right from the laws of Nidah. And David looks at her and says, I can't make a decision in the middle of the night. How am I supposed to see what color it is? So she says to David, remember this famous Gemara. She says, well, David, you made a decision in the middle of the night which you weren't supposed to make. You decided my husband was liable for death. That you don't make a decision like that at night time, only at daytime. She says, so David says, wow, you got me. You're right. You're absolutely correct. And David is so overwhelmed by her arguments and what she does, he says, Brucha ta'ameich u'baruch at, u'brucha at. You are blessed, and so is your reasoning, your ta'am, your taste, literally. In other words, you know, who you are is such a blessed person. And David is bowled over, another way to describe it, by Abigail. She stops him, it says, by showing her thigh, says Tosfot. Doesn't mean that she literally compromised her tzniut, but it says that there's some sense of understanding the connection. There was a warmth, there was a fire, there was kind of a connection there between her and David. Even from a distance, he could sense she was there. So Tosfot kind of sort of fudges that kind of whole description of the Gemara, because it seems to suggest that she really did kind of behave in an immodest way. Says Rav Ferber, I showed you the commentary from another rabbi, who says that the thigh represents the fundamental, the foundation. Doesn't mean that she showed the thigh to David, but she showed to David the fundamental basis on which the decision that he made was wrong. Right? If I'm not mistaken, that's what Rav Ferber said. So he kind of takes the whole description of the thigh as a metaphor, as a kind of means of really understanding how Abigail argued and won the argument against David. In the meantime, Naval has a stroke, he dies, And David has absolutely no compunction whatsoever. He takes Abigail as his second wife. Okay, and that's again King David. The witch of Endor, the five explanations. Was it in the mind of Shaul? Was it something which was a complete con? Okay, it was that the woman set it up, but it wasn't for real, right? That's the big question. Was it for real? So the answer number one opinion says no. Another opinion says it was really imaginary. Shaul imagined it. The non-Jewish opinion is to say that it was a demon, and it was something which was out of their normal control, right? And there were various other opinions. The one that I like, Rabbi Menashe ben Yisrael, if you don't remember his name, but you can remember what he says, that the whole idea of the witch of Endor was that she could relate to a neshama, which is still floating around in this world, even after death has occurred. Because the chapter 28 begins by telling us again that Shmuel had died, and as a result of that whole description at the beginning, we go into the story of the witch of Endor, because she related to the neshama within the 12 months that the neshama is preparing to go to Shamayim. There is a kind of way of connecting to it in this world. It was within that period of time, maybe even shorter, that Shmuel's neshama was still around. So the witch of Endor could connect to the neshama, and Shaul could ask his desperate question, which unfortunately brought about an answer which he didn't want to hear. Tomorrow, imcha ve banecha imadi. Atava banecha imadi macha. Macha atava banecha imadi. I think it's that way around. You will be with me and your sons, he's told tomorrow. He, meaning Shmuel. Shmuel is dead. You, Shaul, are also going to die. Unbelievable story. So again, if there's any kind of discussion on the Witch of Endor, it will revolve around the different explanations for the event. Was it for real or not? Okay? And finally, the suicide of Shaul. Essentially, two opinions. Maybe some more. But the two basic opinions, one which argues that he was not committing suicide, was an exception to the rule, for the simple reason that he was already told he was going to die anyway. So he wasn't really killing a live person, he was killing a dead person. That's not the definition of suicide, right? The Witch of Endor story told him he was going to die. The other suggestion, that's the Radak says that, the other suggestion is that it was onus. He was in an impossible situation because he did not want to be abused by the enemy. The enemy were going to take him and they were going to abuse him, they were going to put him on show, torture him, who knows what they're going to do to him before he died. And he felt that was a terrible chilul Hashem. And as a result of those considerations, Shaul felt the only thing noble for him to do at this point, his sons had already died, was to fall upon his sword. And as we saw, and this is again another beautiful phrase that you can commit to memory, David's reaction when he heard about it is the phrase referring to the family of Shaul, Eich Noflu Giborim, how the mighty have fallen. Right? The brave, Gibor, the heroes. The heroes of Am Yisrael have fallen today in battle, Shaul and his sons. They are the heroes, they are the outstanding people in the Jewish world, and they are no longer with us. Eich Noflu HaGiborim. Another phrase which is certainly worthwhile to mention in any question which may come up about the suicide of Shaul. What a surprise. Okay, so again, I hope you're picking up all the pointers. Bottom line of everything that we just said, in an hour we covered about 4 months worth of learning. Not properly, but you know what I mean. Just Rosh Hashanah. If any of it resonated, I'm very excited. If even a part of it resonated, I'm also very excited. Just by way of Hakaras HaTov, I have to thank... this class is great because I always like the smaller group. Then when I get to remember your names, right? Which some of you... All right, I've seen you a few times, but just a great thing. Although working out who the twins are has always been challenging. I mentioned, well, you know, sisters, but whatever, close enough. So I've had twins as well. But putting it aside, the reality of it is that I think David HaMelech said, "If you call Melandai, his skull to you." You learn from your students more than anything else. Your essays were really excellent. Okay, the work that you produced for me was beyond. You have no idea how much I do appreciate what you do. And at the same time, I hope that you feel you have a kinyan. You've actually learned something. You've got a hold on a fabulous part of Jewish history. For those who are graduating, I would say, you know, good luck. And hopefully sort of see you guys when I come to Miami or whatever. You never know, bump into you. But more to the point, you know, sort of keep the learning alive, keep it going. If you find something interesting like this, why you tell? That's why I encourage it, because it is so important. Don't come out of Stern and say, that's it, close my Tanakh and I'm done. You become the person in the community that organizes the shiur. You organize the Tanakh learning, or you want to learn the Siddur Shiur, whatever you want to learn. Well, like Gemara, you know, for goodness sake, be controversial, it doesn't matter. Do what is important, because, you know, you will become the leaders. You really will very, very soon. And I just want to say again, thank you, because it really is, for me, wonderful to have, you know, to get paid to do what I do. I can't believe I get paid to do this. It's as simple as that. But Baruch Hashem, Yom Yom. Any comments and questions, ribshaf@aol.com. Please don't hesitate. As I said, you will be able to go over this again on YU Torah. And I think at this point, I wish everybody a freilichen, a wonderful and enlightening Hanukkah. I wish everybody well. Okay. Thursday.